Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel discussion this morning. It is a delight to have you with us, and we welcome you to be a part of our program by writing to us during this discussion, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Let me introduce our panel to you this morning. First, we have Dr. Alan Chartok with us. Good morning, Alan.
Yo estoy aquí. I'm here.
Thank you. Excellent. Also, we have the University of Albany professor and investigative journalist, not the only one, but a...
the only one.
Yeah, that one, the one and only. Rosemary Armeo is with us.
Thank
Good morning.
You.
And Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld.
Good morning.
Fresh from a media project taping, so I'm sure you've that's the opening round, right?
It was a relatively benign one, as those things go. So but I shouldn't say that because I think people like it when we're fighting with each other.
Well, you have an hour to make up for that.
Okay,
right?
We can fight.
Good morning
what
and
do you
welcome.
Mean by that?
See, started already.
I'll meet you outside.
Good morning and welcome. Cool. And again, roundtable@wamc.org. Let us talk about the news. First and foremost, let's go to the story in Fort Hood. An Iraq veteran at Fort Hood kills three and then himself in a rampage. The story was obviously dominating the headlines last night. A soldier who was being evaluated for post-traumatic stress disorder opened fire at Fort Hood on Wednesday, killing three people and wounding 16 before killing himself. The shooting set off a huge police response, shut down the sprawling Army base in Killeen, Texas, the same facility where a deadly rampage by an officer resulted in 13 deaths in 2009. And once again, I think, puts that a question. We were talking about this on the show earlier this week about soldiers and post-traumatic stress and the level of the number of suicides, and it seems to me that we can look at the immediacy of this issue, but then also the larger issue of what is happening and how it's being addressed.
Well, it seems like it hasn't been addressed, one aspect of the situation, and that's security on the bases. This was supposed to be something subject to a nationwide review after the shooting at the shipyard in Washington. You recall that a few months ago.
Right.
And they promised a...
And the shooting at Fort Hood, right?
Well, that was 2009, right? And they said, we're going to look at everything coast to coast. And asked about it, the Defense Department, had no answer yesterday. I hardly know what to say about this. The usual response is, oh, guns are dangerous, but it's an Army base. Of course you have weapons there. So
yeah,
I
feel
sure.
The same way as I was watching it. And it almost seems foolish for us to talk about it with any kind of definitiveness. We don't really know what's going on. We know the guy's reported to have had some mental health issues. Well, you know, after Newtown, we talked about how come people didn't recognize that Adam Lanza had mental health issues. Well, they sort of knew this guy had mental health issues. It was an Army base, a military base. There are weapons on the military.
Correct.
I mean, it goes on and on. I just found, and this is me, I'm a half glass half empty sort of guy, and I just watched it with both sadness and aggravation and a sense of resignation that this stuff is just happening in this country more frequently than it should, and I don't see any sign of it stopping. And this is the normal in this country, and I would hope that we can figure out a way so it doesn't happen. But I don't know how we can be confident that that's going to happen.
It is
the more guns there are out there, the more it's going to happen. I don't think there's any question that if guns are available and somebody happens to be a troubled soul or mentally ill person, and there's an access to a gun. And somebody says to the person, you know, go shoot everybody. This is God talking to you, or this is the devil talking to you, or this is your mother talking to you. If the gun is accessible, it creates the possibility of carnage.
Well, I don't know where this guy got his gun, but it is a military base, and
he's
a man.
Well, he was in the Army.
And he's in the military, and he's in a uniform. These are people who are supposed to have guns and presumably know how to use them for the purposes that they were made. So,
except that the Army and the counselors knew he was mentally ill. That's clear because he was being treated at the time.
Well, then why was he, to use a callous expression, on the loose? Why did they not have him in a place where this couldn't
have
happened?
Well, because you don't know. Well, there are people who see counselors and analysts and others, and they're told, and they tell their greatest fears and everything else. They don't put them in jail. You know, this is an assessment in an imperfect mental health system where somebody, a counselor, has to make that decision. And I wouldn't want to be that counselor today, to be honest with you.
Well, and again, had been diagnosed with a post-traumatic stress disorder. We should point that out. I also think one of the other things that struck me about this particular story is that I don't think we're going to have one of these stories where there isn't a line somewhere in this particular story that I'm referencing in the New York Times. It comes in the second paragraph where it says the shooting did not appear to be related to terrorism, and it seems like we're always going to have that as sort of in the back of our mind at some point.
In the 2009 shooting at Fort Hood, there was a connection, a thin connection, because the shooter was of Muslim descent.
Right.
We don't know about it.
So if it was determined to be terrorism, would we be shocked? If it was determined to be mental health issues, would we be shocked? If it was determined that the gun was somehow purchased illegally and used for the wrong reason, would we be shocked? This is a life in the United States of America right now.
And there's no political will to change that. We're defending our Second Amendment more than ever these days.
Well, that's right. I was going to say, if Newtown didn't change it, what's going to change?
What can happen?
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, I think there is a political will. You get Brady and you get an awful lot of people who have that political will. The problem is, Rosemary, there just aren't enough of them.
Yeah, I guess that's what I mean by political will. You have to have a majority, and they don't. And I think some decisions
By the way, I think
the Supreme Court, which we're going to talk about later, make it even worse. You now can spend more money than ever to get your point of view across. So, if anything, it helps the NRA.
Well, no, I'm not so sure that polling isn't showing that a majority of people want some kind of gun control. I think the question is, when you have a powerful minority, whether they can work their will. And I think in this case, that's exactly what's happened. We just saw it outside, right, Joe? We just saw it outside yesterday. We weren't here, but we saw the gathering of the pro-gun people. And there were a lot of them. And they said, this is our highest or one of our highest priorities.
Yes, pro-gun.
And there are politicians.
That's the will of the people and the will of our representatives.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support comes from Ithaca College, a community of scholars and leaders working to help create the future. Ithaca.edu/ready for information. MPAC at Rensselaer, presenting an outdoor screening of Jacques Tati's 1970 film Playtime, a choreographed reflection on life in the modernist society. Tonight at 7:30 p.m., mpac.rpi.edu. And Capital Cities Imported Cars, Glenmont, New York, offering new and pre-owned BMWs and Volkswagens, serving the WAMC listening area since 1975. CapitalCitiesBMW.com.
Good morning and welcome back to our conversation and to our panel discussion. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org. And Alan, do you have a letter in front of you?
I don't, Joe. I'm just counting on you to do that reading today.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Yeah. Christina writes in and says, I'm puzzled why a soldier being evaluated for PTSD in a psychiatric unit on base would have access to a gun. And I think that is a question we alluded to, but certainly one we don't know.
Fort Hood especially should be under review. If you're going to have a nationwide review of security measures to prevent this kind of thing, wouldn't you start at Fort Hood? This is now two deadly incidences there in a few years. So I don't have an answer to that. I hope the Defense Department can supply one soon. Good question.
It is a good question.
It's a good question and a rhetorical question, I'm sure. In other words, Christine was making a statement, this is wrong.
So what's going to happen now is that there's going to be a lot of consternation and there's going to be a lot of hand-wringing, and then it eventually will drift off the public's consciousness and we'll move on to something else until the next one happens.
Meanwhile, William...
Well, you better believe that the Army is meeting on this, that the people at Fort Hood are meeting on this. People want to be promoted. They want to be generals. They say, somebody's going to blame us. And somebody, as Christina just sort of did, is going to blame them. Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. William writes and says, most reasonable people will agree to keep weapons from being sold to felons, criminals, but who decides if someone is mentally stable or not? As we know through history, that has been abused by doctors, husbands, and wives, and ignorance. Again, we welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org. Let's move on to other subjects and talk about a big one about the Supreme Court and the political donation cap. We'll talk about a couple aspects of this. The Supreme Court on Wednesday continued its abolition of limits on election spending, striking down a decades-old cap on the total amount any individual can contribute to federal candidates in a two-year election cycle. The ruling issued near the start of a campaign season will very likely increase the role that money plays in American politics. Well, that's good news, right?
It's now legal to buy an election.
The Supreme Court says it's okay.
Right. It's your right of free expression.
Right. And it's sardonic. You're saying it sardonically, but there are five guys on the Supreme Court. I believe all of them were appointed by Republicans. The four people who were appointed by Democrats voted no on that proposition. The question is, and we have to sort of just move over to, I mean, I'm offended by it, I'll be honest with you, but the question is the spending of one's money in any way one wants to free speech? That's the question. And to some people, that sounds very reasonable.
Yeah, that you're absolutely right. And when you say it that way, doesn't it sound so good and so full of freedom? But what we're talking about is the effect on an election, and not everyone can spend freely. So you are talking about people with much money having much more influence than people like us who don't have access to that kind of funding. So we're talking about unfairness of our elections. Yeah.
Just playing the devil's advocate then. What makes an election or the winning of an election any different than anything else in this society where money talks and all others walk, where the golden rule is that those who have the gold rule? I mean, to their great credit, there were people, outraged people out in front of on our streets in Great Barrington with signs yesterday saying this is awful. And it is awful from my perspective, but it doesn't change the reality that that's what this country is.
Well, you look at this, I'm sorry, Ira, but you look at this in concert with Citizens United, and you certainly get a picture of how we're going.
And there's more to come, because this threw away the cap on total number of candidates you can contribute to. Next will be getting rid of the caps on how much you can spend per candidate. It just follows logically from just what you're saying, Alan.
Well, let me play devil's advocate, too, because I agree with what I sense the floor's opinion is, that this is not a ruling that we like.
But it does not help democracy.
Okay, so now, just again, devil's advocate, there is a presumption, perhaps backed up by fact, that this is a decision which will help the conservatives and the Republicans.
Actually, no.
I'd like to elaborate, because could there not be the same benefit on the left as there might be now on the
right?
Well,
actually, the analysis that I've read show that it doesn't help Republicans over Democrats. Both parties, the established parties, get a huge boost from this. You both can take advantage of going after big donors and getting them to, you know, empty their pockets.
So for every Sheldon Adelson or the Koch brothers, there is a liberal counterpart with a lot of money.
But why I say this is bad for democracy.
Yeah. But why? But then why do the five Republican judges on the Supreme Court, everybody says, oh, they're justices, they're looking at the law. Why do the five Republicans vote one way, the Democrats the other way? Why are Democrats always for expanding the franchise? And so often Republicans are saying, no, no same-day registration, no this, no that.
These rulings on campaign finance and Citizens United, I put in the same category, they just turn around something like 100 years worth of legislation and rulings on campaign finance, on making the playing field even. One man, one vote, as far as not winning office, but deciding who goes into office. We've reversed that. It really isn't Republican or Democrat. It is conservative and liberal. I agree with that. But I don't understand what the role of Congress is in this. They can come back and change everything.
Just to underscore the obvious, can you describe the ramifications of the unlimited spending? I would ask Rosemary and Alan, who are the professors in the House, is it just simply that there is more money to spend on political advertising? Is that the advantage that the unlimited spending will create?
Go ahead, Alan. You can start.
Yes. The answer is yeah. I mean, look, there are 1,000 ways. We just got a letter from Scott, and Scott said campaign finance limits are what created the rise of super PACs. The super PACs run some of the most derisive, and demonizing political advertisements. The candidates claim that they are responsible for what the PACs – they are not responsible.
Yeah, but where is the money? So the money is being spent on advertising, and by advertising we're talking about TV and direct mail?
This is slightly wrong, because Citizens United pertain to the PACs, and they even have fewer limits than this current regulation, which is for big companies and individuals. So the problem is that instead of talking to us, the people, about what we want, here's what we're going to give you in the next election, the parties, both of them, will go courting the biggest spenders. This is why the NRA has power, that they've used their money in huge doses, targeted. Or the unions. Yes, Alan. Absolutely. And so now all of these groups have even more money to spend, giving them more clout. They are the focus of our elections.
And they're
not
spending it
want.
On... advertising.
This ruling doesn't limit it to advertising. Citizens United had some regulations on how the money could be spent, where the money could go, soft spending. But this is directly into the campaign chests of whoever they want.
Meanwhile,
and by the way, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say just what Rosemary was talking about, how the people feel about this. But meanwhile, the Times looked into the sort of the past polling on this. A Gallup poll conducted just in June, 8 in 10 Americans, if given the opportunity, would vote to limit the amount of money candidates for Senate and House races could raise and spend on their election campaigns.
Yes.
Going back to 2012, a New York Times CBS News poll found similar majority support across all demographic groups, political groups, saying about two-thirds of Americans in that survey preferred contribution caps for individuals. And so here we are with the opposite ruling, ruling the land.
Wait, but listen to this. I mean, we're all familiar with the alarming statistic that 1% of this country owns, 20% of it or 40%? I never can get the straight of this, but it's huge. So are we surprised that when the 1% that runs so much of it or owns so much of it says we're going to feather our own nest, or we're going to maintain our political power by doing this? But of course, there's always reaction. Now, Joe, we were talking just yesterday about this, and anybody who has an email account knows that we're hearing from the President of the United States,
right,
from Bill Clinton, from every congressional candidate, saying, you know, hundreds of these saying, it's the last moment of the quarter. We've got to give now,
or
we're going to lose it.
Yeah, yes, we are surprised. So, not that they're asking for it, but that the Supreme Court gave it to them.
We got to hit a break, but we'll be back. We'll continue our conversation. You're listening to the panel roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. And Alan, we got a few letters.
We did. We got one from Anonymous who says it's a little too long to read the whole thing, but I would hazard against the opinion. That a soldier being treated for PTSD should be allowed access to weapons. In fact, shooting and marksmanship in general is a basic soldier's task, and unfortunately, we're not allowed to carry personal weapons on post. Otherwise, this kind of tragedy wouldn't happen. And then,
wait, why the heck is that anonymous, Alan?
Because he's a junior officer.
Aha.
Himself. And that's why it's anonymous. Okay, so, and then Bob says, it bothers me too that people can buy elections, but should the amount of time one donates to a candidate be limited? How about the number of editorials published by a newspaper? How about the amount of time spent in a radio station in support of a political philosophy? I don't think it's necessary, but I think it's necessary to look at the, I don't think I have an answer, but it's necessary to look at the big picture. Okay, and let's see. And then there's from Walker. What is the problem really is that people have to work so hard to get the public to pay attention in caps, pay attention to the running of the country and its social and health problems. That's the real tragedy. Instead, they're paying attention to celebrity and sports, maybe exclusively. You got anything else, Joe?
We got one from, I think we got one from Henry, who writes that I have not heard it mentioned today that the gun used by the shooter was an off-base private purchase of a pistol, which begs the question as to the level of security at the gate, bringing up Rosemary's point about the security at the base overall. And we also got the letter from Kenner. Do you have that, Alan?
No.
Okay.
Go.
Just another work day at the court defining corruption down. Daniel Patrick, Daniel Moynihan wrote about defining deviancy down decades ago. The court's narrow definition of corruption as only a bald quid pro quo is itself a symptom of deep corruption. Russia thinks they have oligarchs. We will show them who is exceptional and what oligarchy is really all about.
The letter about how we can't get people's attention on elections and on the running of the country, I can't see how this decision will do anything else but exacerbate that, because what influence do we have anymore? It's all decided by the moneyed men, so the people will get more apathetic if that's possible.
I think the point that the writer mentioned, the number of editorials that a newspaper could run, I think that one of the justices used that in part of their questioning.
Yes, he did.
But the analogy just doesn't work for me. I mean, you're talking about a private newspaper giving its opinion, whatever side it is, that can be repeatedly giving that opinion, just as Bill O'Reilly can, just as Olbermann can, just as Rachel Maddow can. We're talking about money and what that may mean to level the playing field in the actual campaigning.
A called and said, empty criticisms. Elections have been measured by who has the biggest war chest for years. Republican versus Dem is nonsense. Look at a teachers union in New York since forever, and look at school taxes as a result.
Yeah, that's a point that I think we made. I think that's not incorrect, but the difference is that up to now, there have been repeated attempts by Republicans and by Democrats to try to level the playing field, to allow people to support the causes they want, but do it in a way that everybody had an equal say. What's changed are these rulings since 2010 by the Supreme Court that have made, if you have lots of money, you have lots more influence. That's what's different.
And John called and wrote and said, unions, including mine, would welcome removal from money from politics. This includes PACs and indirect advertising. This is because we can't compete against the money involved even before Citizens United, and the levels will skyrocket higher now. And he said, keep up the great show.
Excellent. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us go to another story. And this is, I know we touched on this a little bit earlier in the week about healthcare, the numbers. I'll watch Rosemary's eyes roll as I read the beginning of this, but that's After months of pummeling by Republicans and with a grim election season approaching, Democrats on Tuesday had a rare bright day. President Obama's announcement that the new health care plan had enrolled 7.1 million Americans coincided with the release by Representative Paul Ryan of a new Republican budget that proposes changes in Medicare and deep cuts in spending. It's far too early to say a political turnaround is at hand, but for the first time this election year, Democrats are having some confidence that they have at least stopped the bleeding for the moment. So,
well, you know, there's a poll out today that shows that confidence in so-called Obamacare or Affordable Health Care Act is increasing and is now even or better than the president's general rating. So things may be turning around.
And, of course, their excitement, their joy was short-lived because the critics of the law immediately said that that 7 million number was a phony number. Krauthammer, in particular, pointing out that this doesn't necessarily reflect 7 million people who have actually paid for health care, but 7 million people who may have selected it and put it, his analogy was, they put it in their internet cart but have not yet paid for it. And you know what? He may be right about that, but I just start from the premise is that this is something that this country needs. It's not the best. It could be improved. It should be improved. And if everybody could get on the page of saying, we've got this, now let's try to make it better, instead of trying to dismantle it, we'd all be better off for it.
Oh, my goodness, that's so Pollyanna.
Listen, I'm known for that.
Yeah, it's that. We've talked about Obamacare. I think the numbers and the polls are all ephemeral. Talk to us next week. We'll have a whole different view of it. What we might mention, though, is this Ryan budget, the Paul Ryan budget, which doesn't really mean anything. There's an agreement on how we're going to spend money for the next couple of years. But it's as a document of where they want to go, I found it terrifying. There's no cuts at all to loopholes in the law. There's no change in the tax code. There's more money for defense, it would roll back the rollbacks, and it would cut all the entitlement programs by huge amounts. And that's the plan.
Right. And this from a very powerful Republican who is often mentioned as a presidential candidate.
Yes, sir.
So you can see where this is going.
And Alan, we've been among those saying, OK, Republicans, you don't like what the Democrats have done. Give us a plan. And so he has done that. And the plan is scary.
Yeah. And Joe's got Jimmy Carter on later. I saw him interviewed a week or so ago where he said the Republicans have Congress. There's an excellent chance that they're going to have the House. And so, you know, rather the Senate. So, you know, that they're going to move forward and try to repeal this. Now, Obama will never sign onto a repeal, but that's where they're going, particularly if they win the entire Senate.
A good point. I'm not sure I made that clear. The budget does call for complete repeal of affordable care. I also am amazed that despite all the cutting, it does not project. It does not have a balance in there. It doesn't have we don't get any money back. We're not balancing the budget, which is supposed to be the main aim, unless a hypothesis he has that if you make all these cuts he wants, business will be stimulated, which has not worked, right? Didn't Reagan start that? It's never worked. So it's not even going to be balanced after these horrible cuts he's made.
Yeah, the other point I was going to make is the Bill Maher point of view. Another noted philosopher, you got Bill Maher and you've got John Stewart. Bill Maher's point of view is that the Republican critics of Obamacare have the Democrats, particularly those who are running for election in this cycle, on their heels. And so the Democrats, as they go out on the campaign trail, are largely distancing themselves from Obamacare, or they're saying, we know it's lousy, but we're going to try to fix it, as opposed to what Maher contends that the Democrats ought to do, which is to stand up and say, this country needed this kind of health care.
We took action.
More people are covered now than there were before. More people will continue to get covered. And to the extent that we need to make it better, let's make it better. But they're on their heels and they're letting the Republicans take the argument to them. And that's not a good strategy.
No.
I don't.
So do you think Obama? So do you think Obama is listening to Maher? In other words, the speech last week in which he got up up and took credit for it and said, you know, we're doing well and it's all going well. That is a little bit of what Mara's calling for, isn't
it? Yeah,
it
is. And what he needs is for the next voices you hear to be his fellow Democrats saying, yeah, right, instead of the next voices you hearing are the Democrats sort of wishy-washy about it, and the louder voices are the ones on Fox or elsewhere or the Republicans in Congress who are getting up and saying, no, this is just the president with his own agenda that he's just trying to fool. And, of course, they all fall back now on, you know, when he said, if you want your health plan, you can keep your health plan, as a sign of his credibility.
And the numbers that we began this segment with are a sign of that. Reading about this milestone yesterday was like doing a math lesson. Everybody was using different numbers, and journalists were trying to sort them out. What's the accurate number, 7 million or 5 million, which is what Boehner used? Which one's accurate or not? We should not be talking about them. Democrats should not be talking about this at all. It should be the movement forward. It should be the effort to make health care affordable for everyone in this country. It should be looking at what's happening with health care costs right now. That's what we should
and
be
talking
about.
And if it is 5 million, that's not chicken feed.
And back to what Alan was saying, if you know, as the polls are indicating that the public shift, there's a public shift on this and more approval, and I believe as Alan indicated, even more approval for this law than there is for the president himself, that you ride that train as well.
Democrats just are not good campaigners, I have concluded. Do you remember when John Kerry was running? No man running at the time had a war record like his. He was a genuine medaled hero in Vietnam. And yet the debate was whether he was a real hero in Vietnam.
Right.
How did that come about?
Happens because they say it over and over and over again until somebody salutes.
Well,
and don't you see the same thing?
Back,
yeah, he doesn't say anything forceful back. That's exactly what we're talking about here.
Sure.
Yeah. And isn't that why Clinton was elected, certainly the first time, if not the second, that he did forcefully take the debate. He brought the debate to it's the economy, stupid, or whatever the lines
well,
were.
Well, and he did it for Obama in this election, too, let's point out.
And
his
we'll do it for Hillary.
Because you have to look tough, because if you want to win an election, you get in a tank and you put on the helmet and you go.
Oh, yeah, that worked really well for another Democrat.
Let's take a break.
Peter wrote to us. Okay.
No,
Peter wrote to us and said, you know what they say about democracy? The poor think we already have it and the rich pray we never do. So that's from Peter.
And on those words, we'll take a break. We'll be back after this short.
Support comes from Kern Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, hosting a national symposium on life insurance compliance November 12th through the 14th at the Gideon Putnam Resort, Saratoga Springs. KernCompliance.com. Empire State Youth Orchestra and the Cathedral of All Saints presenting a benefit concert for Northern Rivers Family Services this Friday at 7 p.m. in the Cathedral of All Saints, Albany, New York. ESYO.org. And Washington County Tourism announcing Tour of the Bat and Kill cycling race, 65-mile course featuring expo, art show, vendors, Main Street activities, and more. This Saturday and Sunday, WashingtonNYCounty.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let's go to another story. Health clinics in offering abortions in Texas filed a federal lawsuit on Wednesday to block a new state rule that could shut down more than half of the state's remaining providers this fall, forcing women seeking an abortion in southern and western Texas to drive several hundred miles each way or go out of state. The rule, part of a sweeping anti-abortion law passed last year, requires that all clinics providing abortions at any stage of pregnancy, including non-surgical drug-induced abortions, meet the costly building standards of ambulatory surgery centers. And this Texas story just going on, I guess, right? Mm-hmm.
It is. I have to. I don't like their tactic, but I have to admire it. They could not get around Roe v. Wade. They cannot attack abortion straight on. So now they're going for the quality of the healthcare facility. It's almost like what you said, Alan, before about free speech and money. How can you argue against, oh, we want women to be safe, so the abortion clinics have to measure to new standards?
Well, you can actually argue against it very easily, Rosemary. You can say it's nonsense. They're not doing that with everything else that goes on in their hospitals or their emergency rooms or anything else. They're doing it, and everybody knows it, because they want to stop women from having abortions. So I don't admire it. I think it's despicable. But what can I tell you?
Yeah, I hope they don't win. That's certainly for sure. But I do admire how flexible they are in their tactics. And they have made great inroads against abortion by doing this sort of thing. The other side has to get smarter.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say the opposition is relentless. If you think that you have survived the opposition, what was the I don't even remember, was it like the Roadrunner, or you turn around and say, oh, there he is again, or right. Butch Cassidy right. and the there, who are those guys? They just keep going after
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Yeah. That's true. And you know, it's not just abortion that's getting this tactic head on, but so is voter suppression in states across the country right now. We thought that was won on the federal level, so the opponents have gone to the state, and they are fighting this case by case relentlessly, and they're making inroads.
Yeah. The difference really is one thing is to stop poor people from voting. The other is, if you truly believe abortion is murder, and many of these people do, believe me, I have neighbors who do and others who do, then you feel that you have a duty to God and to whatever else to put a stop to it. Now, of course, I think if you don't believe in abortion, and if you don't want your child to have one, and she or he fights back against it, that's one thing. But don't tell my child, if she were to want one, that she couldn't have it out of your religious principles. That's where I go south on the whole thing.
I have sort of a problem with this being such an issue in Texas, which has the highest execution rate by far of any state. If you believe in right to life, then how come only for fetuses, not for people who have done bad things?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to make it a moral argument, you got some moral answering to do here.
You got to think it through.
Yeah, but yeah. It's never stopped anybody, you know. It hasn't stopped anybody from making any argument.
Oops. Oof.
Alan has.
Wow, Alan that's is one gone. Way Alan's to take care of Alan. Right. Man, I want to know how to.
Having
do
some
that.
Microphone problems, we'll get that taken care of. Oh. All right, so
over and over
there
again.
There you go.
And over again.
Okay. Yeah, you went away for a little while. Yeah. We were having problems
and
with your
again.
Mic, but you're good. Okay. So let's move on. Two members of the Senate Intelligence Committee on Wednesday announced their support for declassifying parts of a long-delayed report on the CIA's defunct detention and interrogation program, all but assuring that the committee will approve the report and send it to President Obama for eventual release. And this is... effectively ended any suspense about whether the committee's chairwoman, Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, will have enough votes to declassify the voluminous report's conclusions and executive summary, which are said to make up about 400 pages of the 6,300-page report.
Correct. This stuff makes me crazy.
This is an incredibly important story.
Go ahead, Alan. How come?
It's an incredibly important story. And I just want to say the moment that the secret agencies of government have control over what their overseers, in other words, their alleged overseers, the Senate, the House, have to say, the moment they do that, this is a very scary place to be. Now, Feinstein is not some bomb-throwing, liberal. Feinstein was a supporter of these agencies, and now she is really in the fight of her life over this. And so it's very scary and much more important than a lot of the other things we talk about.
I don't think this information is ever going to get to the American people, at least in my lifetime. I think that there is widespread belief that it should not get out, and I believe it goes to the White House. I think the most of the legislators think this. We are not going to find out about torture because it's going to make everybody look bad. This is the Pentagon Papers of our time.
Yep. Can't
hey, Joe, we've gotten a whole bunch of letters.
I was just going to ask you. Let's go to the letters.
Okay, so Brandon says, we keep hearing on the media that Affordable Care Act is a success based on the fact that more people have health insurance. To me, the success is only that of the health insurance companies. There are Americans who take their health care into their own hands, can afford to pay for out-of-pocket emergency if need be. But from my perspective, we're being forced to buy a product we don't need or want that's not success. Call me old-fashioned, but I think the success of this program should be measured by the approval of the American people, because that should be the ultimate goal. And Cynthia takes us to court and says, dear all, I truly enjoy the lively discussions on the roundtable. However, you are discussing something extremely serious. Or a tragic event that happened at Fort Hood yesterday. All of you tend to lower your voices. They become very low, and I'm left wondering, what did he or she say at the end of the sentence? I'm pretty sure you aren't aware of this. Again, I look forward to an hour's discussion every weekday. Very nice.
That's interesting. And we have to pay attention to that. Yeah.
Well, especially you. So then Jim writes, the difference between the amount of editorials and the amount of volunteer time that somebody gives a campaign is that regardless of financial means, any individual can do those acts. Donated funds can only be done by those who have a certain income level that gives certain advantages to people with money over people with money in politics.
Good point.
Let people use their time. Okay, I think that's right, Jim. But he's answering somebody else who called in. What else you got, Joe? Anything?
That's what I got. I was just following you down the list. You got
down the list. Yeah.
Did you get Russ?
Russ, no.
The law being struck down allowed a donor to contribute $5,200 to 25 candidates, but not 26. Explain to me why you believe this is constitutional.
You know, going back to healthcare, only two of us on this program right now can relate to this, but I'm on Medicare now. And when Medicare was formed, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it, although I take it there was a significant amount of discussion and fighting in Washington about whether this was a good program. And then when they added to Medicare to cover the drug, the donut hole, that whole thing. Now I'm on Medicare. I'm very happy that I have Medicare. It's not perfect.
Paul Ryan is not happy you're on it. He wants to make it a voucher.
Well, my point is this, and I'll use the phrase probably incorrectly, universal health care is something that is important for this country, for people who need the health care, and they should have the health care. And there is a means through this bill, this law, to get the health care. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, Pollyanna or not, there are flaws, clearly, with the way this law was unleashed, not just the internet connections, and it needs to be improved. But I can't imagine that if we're not sitting here in this studio in 25 years, I will probably have expired, at least expired my Medicare, that we won't be saying that this was a landmark legislation for this country and the country is better off for it. And so to the writer's point, there are people who don't want to be forced into getting health care and paying for health care, but they're in theory contributing to the better good of the entire country. And if they're healthy enough,
exactly.
Right now, and if they're healthy enough right now that they don't need it, well, wait a few years.
Well, exactly. And Ira, let me point out what I think this is all about and has been all about for some time. If you're putting 30 million people or more on the healthcare rolls, these are people who could not afford healthcare before. That's so important for us to remember. And it's also part of what motivates so many people to oppose it. They say, why should they who can't afford it have it. Well, that's absurd, and it goes right to your point, Ira, and congratulations.
Well, we're also paying for, if they didn't have health care and they got sick, we would be paying for it. We, the rest of the country, the taxpayers of this
country.
Yes
and no. There are some people who will die. I mean, we know that the African-American death rate is higher. We know that the diabetes is higher and not managed and the rest of it. And part of that, it's not that all poor people are African-American, by the way, but we know that there is this thing that relates to both of this, and that's what this is, in my mind, all about.
We are out of time, but thank you very much for weighing in. Roundtable at WAMC.org. The discussion will continue. Professor Rosemary Armeo, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Alan Chartok, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And our own little Haley Mills.
I don't even have a title.
Ira Fussfeld.
Oh, man. Call me Doc, even though I'm not.
All right.
I've seen a doctor once or twice.
Or at least call him Duck.
Duck, right.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.